President, I hope that helped.
Okay. Mr. Cleveland?
Bill.
What is the correct way to write inventory?
Obviously, the right person has the question.
I just don't know.
False humility. Spiritual
pride. The correct way. Here's my opinion.
But it's a really good one.
And it should be yours. Can we say that again?
And it should be yours.
Good. Excellent.
I love this retreat.
These people really get it.
This is one of the best retreats I've ever been to. I hope that's on the tape. In the book, I believe it's very clear. It's looking for three things: resentments, fears, and broken relationships, or the sex list. People call it the sex list. There's an argument within Alcoholics Anonymous as to whether or not the resentment list is three columns with a separate faults and mistakes list, or is it four columns? I'm a four-column guy. I understand people that talk about that fourth column being a separate list of faults and mistakes, but usually what they'll tell you is that you can link it to the resentments because you're looking for your defects of character. So they've essentially got a weak fourth column. You know, to me, there's four columns. The fear list is a separate list, and the relationship list, or the sexual relationship list, where have I instilled jealousy, caused bitterness, and so on and so forth, the sex list, there it is. Now, the secrets, we all talk about the fifth step of telling secrets. It doesn't seem like in that body of that that it's asking for that. But if we look at it like putting yourself on the resentment list, the feelings that I have towards myself, the resentment that I have towards myself, you can kind of fill in that gap there. There were things that I did that where no one else was present. One of them involved a vacuum cleaner.
Yes.
Should I show him the picture from the museum?
No pictures. We were in Den Haag in The Hague, and we found a vacuum cleaner museum, and we went, him and I, and took pictures. We're just weird.
And, he says they're special.
But, where was I?
I'm glad that's on the
table. Don't involve other people.
There are things that don't involve other people. A lot of it has to do with childhood stuff that we carry around with us. And we think we're the only ones that are that weird or that sick. And we have negative feelings about ourselves because of that. We think that's who we are. In that category of resentments towards myself, that's where that stuff would lie. And when I exposed that, when I told those stories, the power of it went away. And he told me there will come a time where you'll share all of this from the podium. A lot of it's not appropriate to do that, but it has no more power anymore. And I've heard enough fifth steps to realize that I'm not the only vacuum cleaner person. That, you know,
Small appliances.
And I never molested my pets like some of you have. I want you to know I'm not in that. We are in the South, so there's probably a lot of that.
What's the phrase? That's not my particular form of sin.
Yes. So, I mean, I think that that's the correct way. Now, when you say that that's the correct way, that alludes to that evidently there is an incorrect way to do the inventory. And the only times I've ever rejected an inventory that somebody has brought to me is when they've written down a life story and they haven't separated the resentments and the fears and stuff. They haven't really looked at it in the context of which AA looks at it, which came really from the Oxford group, you know, that historical lineage. You know, this is what these people did that seemed to work. I believe in that process. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't write a life story. That's fine, and you can even read it to me. But I want you to do it like this. Let's really look at the resentments. Because what I'm looking for is I want you to finally take responsibility for your behavior. The end result of doing that inventory is that we take responsibility, we stop blaming others, and we look at what our faults and mistakes are. And that particular structure of the inventory really drives that home. Should you stay sober for a long period of time, you're going to do more inventories and you're going to be really focused on that fourth column. I mean, that because that is where everything lives. So that's...
I'd like to kind of chime in. I got some stuff on the sex inventory that I'd like to speak to. First of all, I live with a spectacular and very active alcoholic. She's sober a long time, sponsors some very special needs people. And Adele, when she has the people that she works with write their sexual inventory, and one of the things that we do now is making sure that, you know, you write down everybody. You know, and if it can only be, I think she was a brunette in 1973 at the J&M. If you can remember that much, you put it on the list. And that you, with each of these people, that what you do is you go through the questions specifically, not just did I arouse jealousy, but how did I arouse jealousy? In other words, yes, I knew the woman was married. You know, that kind of stuff. That, you know, and the more you can flesh that out, the more you are able to experience the power of redemption. Okay. The second thing is that I want to mention is that you know, I talked about this inventory that I did it that at 14 years it was very important. Bill was around, what were you, 9 when you did that one?
9 or 10.
Yeah. Matthew, I don't remember. No, Matthew's hasn't reached that. He's worked the steps correctly. But he's benefited from our knowledge and experience. But my wife, God bless her, another time that I did a really thorough house cleaning and really cleared the deck, I think it's really important that we acknowledge the significant times in our lives. So at 5, at 10, at 15, at 20, at 25, you know, get a brand new big book. Sit down with somebody that you are not in charge as either as a peer or a mentor, and go through the steps again. Go through the experience. Do it with a different aspect of your life. And my fabulous wife did it on her thinking at her 20th year and had an amazing, she went through a step group with a group of people and had a killer experience. And when it came to her inventory, her sexual inventory, because, I mean, one of the things is we've been together for 17 years. I mean, there's only 2 people on the inventory. Anymore, you know? There's me.
It's really kind
of
sad.
Yeah, I know. It's pathetic. I mean, monogamy is not even a list of an institution that I have a resentment against anymore. I mean, it's... But anyway. But it came part to the thing about our sexual ideals. And she came to me and she said, can I read you my sexual inventory? And, you know, she sat down and went through it with me. And there's only one way that you can... She said, is there anything that you'd like to say after she read this to me? And there's only one thing I could say. I could say, could I please have 2 weeks? Because the only thing that I could possibly do with her sharing with me about, you know, the reality of her side of our relationship, you know, just things like making sure that I knew that she was asleep when she wasn't, when I came home sometimes from the meeting, because she didn't want me trying to have sex with her, you know, things along those lines. The only thing that I could possibly do, I know nobody's ever done anything like that here. In California, it's an art form. But anyway, what...
Roll over.
I'm not dead yet. But what happened was is that she... So I had to go and write a sexual inventory. so that I could sit down. And then what we did is that we actually sat down together. Now, this is me at the time. I got 31 years of sobriety. She's got 20. We got half a century in the deal together. We've heard, we've each done, you know, at least 10, 15 inventories. We've heard hundreds, maybe thousands between the two of us. And for the first time, we're sitting down to shape our sex life together. Like, I went around to a bunch of people. I thought, this is really, I don't remember hearing anybody talk about this. And what happened is that we were able to talk about the things, the little nickel and dime stuff that over time turns into resentments, justifiable ones, and about how it is that we could not only learn to communicate sexually together, but also how it is that we could grow more closely together. And how do you do that? Well, you know, tomorrow I'm gonna talk about, you know, actually doing the 11th step. And but here in the big book, I got it on the phone, and you know, it talks specifically about shaping our sexual ideal. And it's not just about who's on whom, but it's really about how is it that we can express affection to each other in a way that we can both have as much fun as possible, and also that we can learn to serve each other. Because part of the difficulty is trying to pretend that we're both going to be ready to be intimate at the same time. That, you know, doesn't happen that frequently over a month's time. But how is it that I can come to you and say, baby, I want to play, in such a way that you don't feel that I'm using you, you don't feel that I'm demanding time, that it's, you know, how can I do it at a time of day that's comfortable for you? Those kinds of things that unless you sit down and have the adult conversation, all you do is you don't ask because you think you know what's going to happen, which means that I just walk around frustrated and angry, or, you know, I go off and take care of myself. And I've got a spectacular wife who loves me. So, you know, it was really a marvelous, marvelous thing. And if you're fortunate enough to share your life with another person that's on this path, or one that at least appreciates what it is that you do and would like to be involved more intimately in shaping something that can be a whole lot of fun, I'd highly recommend it. All I can tell you is I have more fun with my wife today than I did 10 years ago. And that's generally not what happens with people. And we've been together 17 years. And I mean, part of it is, for me anyway, was that when I started courting her, I said, I want to be chasing you around the table, trying to pull off your girdle when you're 89 years old. And so every time that I see we're getting a little bit older, I know that I'm living the dream. And so,
next question.
Go ahead.
Okay. What do you do with the amends that you know will damage more than if you don't do it? I'm going to put this together with this one. So what do you do with the amends that you know it will do way more damage than to not do it, but you know you cannot move on if you don't? And the other one is, I'm unsure of making amends to someone, a couple, because it involves my knowledge of a participation in a partner in their business, cheating them. I receive no part of the money. So this one, both of these go are discussions with your sponsor. This one about that I received no part of the money. If you did no harm, you owe no amends. If you're ratting somebody else out, that's not an amends. You make amends for people you harm. If you played a role in the harm, then you owe an amends. That's what I would say. But I think this is a particular situation that needs to be discussed with somebody, because clearly this isn't all the details. What do you do with the amends that you, you know, we do more damage than good? I need to move, do it to move on. It says in the book, you know, we don't unload on people for to make our conscience better.
Absolutely.
And actually, Jay and I and Bill were talking with someone at the break about situations where you owe amends and you don't know how to pay the money back, or there's a weird situation. And this may help with this a little bit, is that if you feel you owe the amends, but it's going to hurt somebody, you can make the amends to the universe. And my situation wasn't that it was going to hurt somebody, but I couldn't find this girl. She let me move into an apartment, and she let me float on the, she paid the deposit, and I didn't pay the deposit, and she said, just pay me when you can. And I've searched for her, I've used Zaba search, I've tried every internet search I can find, and I owed her like $350, so... You know, when a guy would come along and he needed to get into a local rehab and it was $100, I paid it. And then when I paid $350 to the universe, I thought, I've finished with the lease. If the lease pops up in my life, I owe her $350. But I'm 18 years sober and I've been trying for a long time to find her. So that may help in this situation. You really don't do more harm than good, so you can move on. So that's my, that's those two.
On the fourth step, I put people who I hate fucking can't stand. That's a specific category.
Yeah, actually crossed out hate.
They crossed out hate, but fucking can't stand. Got it.
Yeah.
Some go to my amends list. What about people I harmed but didn't do anything to me? Eighth step. Now, at the eighth step, it says that we have a harms list. We made it when we did the inventory. So there's some people, and I've actually done it this way. I don't know that it makes any big difference, but, you know, when you're really looking at the big book like a Bible and you're doing it chapter and verse and you're looking for the secret code, you know, to really extend your life, if you really want to do it correctly, you know, you start breaking all this stuff down, and evidently we mysteriously made this harms list, and it doesn't... I actually got an email from a guy that was a page long quoting chapter and verse trying to find the instructions for the harms list, and I had to tell the guy, sorry, there aren't any. You're just going to have to kind of figure out what a harms list is. You know?
And I hope, like, he hears the tape.
People I harm, I think, go on the list.
What's a harm, Bill?
What's a harm? You know? So, but this, if I understand this correctly, is, you know, on the eight-step list, you take all the resentments and you put them on that list, because the goal of the ninth step is to rid us of resentments. But also, there's another category. There's liquor stores I robbed. People I stole from that don't necessarily didn't do anything to me. I don't have a resentment against them. I just took their money. And that goes on the eighth step. That's a separate category. You know, there's emotional amends, there's financial amends, there's spiritual amends. You know, there's kind of categories of amends. And, you know, this would be something that you would just put on your eighth step because you did. Here's another one that kind of goes along with it. If I sponsor, seemingly, if a sponsee, seemingly, refuses to do the four step, what should a sponsor do? You can't make them do it, but you can make them really uncomfortable. You can get them to where they'll actually quit going to meetings for fear that you might be there, glaring at them across the room. You know? And I don't know of anybody who really hasn't balked at the four step. I've had a couple of guys that actually showed up with it done after like a week or two, and I thought, this guy's not out.
That's the same thing. That's the same thing.
Way too efficient, you know, for an alcoholic, you know. But mostly we all balk a bit. You know, I did. I took a, you know, couple of months or something. I probably was more efficient than most. You know, I've had guys that I've had for years that just haven't done their fourth step. You know, I've got some guys that are 5-6 years sober that I've never done a fourth step with. Maybe they came from another sponsor or something, and I've told them, well, you need to do that, and we've read the book, and we got to that point, we stopped reading, and they're just going, hey, Bill, how you doing? You know, they just haven't done it. And, you know, what are you going to do? You know, I can't make you do anything. I just can't. I'm not a hard-ass sponsor. There's an allusion to that, you know.
I got an amendment.
Yeah. Okay, the follow-up on this is, the answer is, you know, you just can't do it, you know.
Wait,
go ahead.
Just to interject, you can't make him do it, but you also don't have to listen to him to complain anymore.
Exactly.
Because then when they come to you with she and this and my job, you go, well, dude, I'm sorry, you're not doing what I do, so you're not getting the solution. If you did a fourth step and a fifth step and a ninth step, these things may take care of themselves, but I am not your therapist. I am your sponsor and alcoholics.
Very good. Very good. Step 5. What exactly should a sponsor do or say during a fifth step? My feeling about the fifth step for me personally is that when you come to me with your fifth step, it's time for you to talk. And I try my best just to keep my mouth shut and let you finish it.
This is an evolution of God's
monumental proportion.
This is part of me listening to you. And it's your turn now. You've done the work. Let's have it. Now, if you ask me a question or you want some feedback from me, I'll do that. But usually my experience with somebody that's got some time, it's kind of a different experience. Because you're dealing with somebody that maybe you've known for a long time, and this maybe is the second or third inventory you've done with this guy, something like that. That's kind of a different animal. You know, that's a sit in the backyard, smoke a couple of cigars, and take a whole afternoon and really talk about life. And I love that. I mean, I love that relationship with you and the fact that the honesty comes so easy and it's so open and you're not threatened and you're not embarrassed. The new guy is a different, he's walking in with fear and trepidation. He's got some stuff on here that makes him nervous. And my feeling is the quicker he gets through it, and then we can talk later sometime about, because I'll take notes. I'll take notes about stuff that I want to talk to you about later. Mm-hmm. So I try to, let's just get her done, you know, get her done and get through it. And that's kind of how it is. But I'll tell you something about this. Every person you work with is different.
Yeah.
Our neuroses are really uncannily similar. But each person is really different. Some people are very outgoing and big talkers. Other people are very quiet and reserved, frightened and fearful. You know, I've heard many fifth steps that just weren't good enough. And I've told people, that's not good enough. You know, and I've looked right at guys and I've said, why don't you just trust me and tell me the whole thing? You're not sleeping with me. You're not working for me. You don't owe me any money. You know, we're just here because we're doing Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you just take a big risk and just trust me? I have to know that I'm trustworthy. This is all about 6 and 7 now. You know, if I say that to somebody, am I trustworthy? Can I be the keeper of your secrets? Can you trust in that? And today I can say unequivocally, yes, you can trust me with that. So, you know, I'll try to get the guy to really drag it out. Maybe he can't write it all down. Maybe he just needs to talk to me. Some guys just can't write it down. And I'll let him, okay, talk to me. Tell me, you know, let's go over these resentments. Some of them you have to ask him questions to keep him going. You know, well, then what happened? You know, he'll write down, well, I hate my father. You know, he was just really an asshole. How did it make me feel? He scared me. And what was my part? Oh, I don't know. Tell me about Daddy. You know, like when you say, what kind of an asshole? Did he beat you? Did he rape you? Did he, you know, what happened? Some guys you have to kind of drag it out with him. Mostly though, it's your turn to talk to me.
A couple of really quick ones on this. Our friend Clint Hodges said, you know, an inventory only takes 2 weeks. Only takes 2 weeks to do it, to write a first step. Some people it's 2 years and 2 weeks. Some people it's 2 months and 2 weeks, but it only takes 2 weeks, right. The other great story about the fifth step that I love is we have a friend, Tom Weston, and his sponsor is Monsignor Ritchie, and Tom's a Jesuit, and so anyway, Tom is just filled with shame and remorse and guilt. you know, comes and does his fifth step with Terry. Terry listened to it, and it was long. And
doctoral thesis.
And Tom gets done, and he's waiting for, you know, the judgment of the uber Jesuit to be visited upon him, all the wrath of Roman Catholicism throughout the ages to be funneled down upon his shoulders now. And Terry looks at him and he says, I think this shows that we both need Alcoholics Anonymous desperately. And got up and left. It's got one here. That's fine.
That's a really good one.
Yeah. Do you have resentments that come back to haunt you in different forms?
Voodoo.
Yeah. I believe that in the it says I can switch from brunettes to redheads. I can date only natural blondes. Yes, of course. I mean, it happens. It happens frequently until I deal with the fear underlying the resentment. Until I'm willing to amend and change my behavior in such a way that I don't keep manifesting this in my, you know, in my relationships one way or another.
Yeah. If what I'm bringing to the table is resentment and fear, how can my relationships be anything other than traumatic and dramatic?
Well, and if, you know, that's such an important point. The resentment is the circumstance of your problem. That circumstance could be anything. It's if the problem is yours. So yeah, do they come back and haunt me with different characters? Yeah, I will fill in the blank. If I'm not mad at her this week, it's him next week. You know, and that anger, that whatever that rule is that they're breaking, that puts them back on my list, is my false rule that the world has to live by. And all of this is about freedom. All of this is about freedom. So you can justify and stay in pain, or take a look at yourself. And then the circumstances tend to become not so tied up in knots. That's my experience.
Here's a really good one.
A really good one.
Does mental illness, specifically bipolar disorder, really affect a person's ability to get and stay sober? Yes. I think it does. My experience is that it does. I think most people that you talk to that are willing to work with people that have mental illness or bipolar disorder, whatever, however that manifests it, whatever your definition of that is that I think they have an extra monkey on their back. I'll tell you one thing for sure, these people should not drink. You know, I have a story about that I love to tell because it was my personal experience. I think the worst thing that happens to these people in AA is they get rejected. There's a lot of people that will not work with people that are on medication, whatever that means. And they'll come up and ask somebody for help and they'll tell you, I'm on medication, and they'll be rejected. I don't work with people on medication for a variety of reasons. The best reason I've heard was somebody that I was quite close to for a long time that told me, my mother was schizophrenic. I was raised by an insane woman. And when I get around those people that have those kinds, it just freaks me out. I can't deal with them. It's not a rejection of them because they're on medication or something. She just personally can't deal with it. It makes her too nervous and anxious to be around that. I've got a handful of people that are all medicated and drooling and stuff, and I have one guy, Kevin, that called me today, and I haven't called him back, and he's very anxious about that. And Kevin is a walking physician's desk reference. And when I get somebody that's on medication, I'll say to them, what are they giving you? And I list it. And I call Kevin, I go, what's this? Because Kevin's on all of it. Or has been at one time, and he's very smart. He's not stupid. He's just crazy. And I had one guy one time who was in this room. I had John that I was dragging around. God, this guy was a drooler. This guy was messed up. You know, I mean, he made me nervous. And and it's a longer story about John. But anyway, John's in the car, and he's this like, just really spaced out, clearly loaded on something. And I go, what have they given you? What are you taking? He goes, Risperidol. Okay, so I called Kevin, and I said, what's Risperidol? And Kevin went, ooh. I said, bad stuff. He goes, oh, that's some heavy shit, man. And he said to me, is he drooling? And I said, kind of, yeah. And he said, what's it for? And he goes, well, they give that to schizophrenic people to hear voices and stuff, to stop the voices. Jeez. So next time I'm with John, right, and I say, do you hear voices? He looks at me and he goes, not anymore. And I said, what do they say? And he goes, well, I can't quite make it out, but I listen really carefully. Oh, man. Just made the hair on the back of my neck stand up, you know. But here's my thing about it. We've said earlier, I can't be your therapist. If you have especially interesting neuroses, I will try. But I'm no good at it. My experience of trying to be your therapist, trying to help you work through some other stuff, has not been good. I'm not a professional. And I know a couple of guys that are professional that are very good at that. You know, that's what they do for a living. And if that's what you need, that's what you need to go. But I can't do that. That's not my job in your life. I can be a spiritual guide. I can be somebody to help you, guide you through the process of the 12 steps and try to put you in touch with the power. There's a lot of things I can do for you. There's also quite a few things I cannot do. And I cannot prescribe for you medication. I can come to understand what's going on with you, though. If you explain it to me, I will retain the information, and I'll be able to use that later. Well, I'll understand you better. You're bringing this to the table. And if I listen to you, I can find out what's really going on with you, like what the history of your problem is, and whether you think it's real or not, whether you think you should be on medication. We can have that discussion. If you want to try to get off the medication, my wife and I both will help find a doctor that will help you do that and see if that works for you. I'm not going to tell you to not take the medication. You know, I can't do that. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. And sometimes I think I know what's best for you. I'm convinced that isn't true. You know, this tells me that I might know, but I really don't. One of the best things I think Adele told me, we were talking one time about people on medication and whether they should be taking it or not and whether they overprescribe it and stuff. And Adele said something to me. She goes, it's really hard for them to recover if they're dead. And some people, when they don't take their medication, they die. They kill themselves or take somebody else out, and then we've all probably been close to something like that happening. People have demons I don't have. And when I don't have them, it's hard for me to relate to your demons. That's why I think it's more difficult for these people to recover. They have extra demons. Here's my role in all this, and I believe very strongly about this. It's my opinion, but it's one of my better, extra special good opinions.
And should be yours.
God, I'm loving this. I'm taking you people home with me. Here's the deal. When someone walks into Alcoholics Anonymous and they ask for help, they should never, ever be rejected. Ever. If I'm responsible for the hand of AA being there for anybody that reaches out for help, then I need to take on that job. I have no idea why you've been sent to me. I'm really clear on why the medicated bipolar people have been sent to me, is to educate my ass, because there's so much of it going on. Should everybody be on medication? Absolutely not. Is it overprescribed? Absolutely it's overprescribed. You're reading more and more about it all the time now. They've overshot the mark like they always do. You know, they overshoot the mark. Every time some alcoholic walks in and says, I'm depressed, they give him some medication. They don't know anything different. When the alcoholic walks up to me and says, I'm depressed, I say, you ought to be. You've been a fucking pig for years. You know, depression is the appropriate emotional response for a loser like you. You know? So So let's work on getting you out of the depression. Let's work some steps. Alcoholics Anonymous is the best antidepressant known to man.
And it's blue.
Yeah.
It's useful.
You know? But it's, you know, I mean, this is what I believe. And this is my job for you. I don't care if you're on medication. And if it doesn't work out between you and I, we'll find that out sooner or later. It's not up to me to determine whether you're correctly alcoholic or not for me to work with. That's arrogance beyond even my ability to deal with it. You know, so I need to sit and just do my job. And whether or not you're on medication really doesn't matter. My experience with it, however, has not been very good. You know, I've got a few guys that have been sober for a while. That have been on medication for a long time. But I see these people kind of struggle, in my opinion. It's a harder struggle. There's other stuff going on that can be organic or emotional, I'm not sure.
And they aren't really engaged AA members in the same way. You know, when I think of John and Kevin and a lot of these guys that I've worked
fringe.
With too. Well, it's not the fringe, it's just their ability to engage. They don't have the same skill set.
That's true.
So they can't be involved in the recovery process in the same way. And
So just lastly about this, it doesn't prohibit you from getting sober. Bill Wilson struggled with depression. It's addressed in the book. The doctor talks about it. It's a very common thing. So I think clearly we can talk about these extreme cases. But bipolar, my father was bipolar. The medication can be quite effective and not too dramatic, and you certainly have the ability to be honest, constitutionally honest, and it's available.
And we're very fortunate that at the last General Service Conference, we've re-edited the AA member and medications. And so there's going to be some new stuff coming out that'll give a nice guideline to help us with all of that.
I got into an argument a bit with a heavy hitter AA guy that professes that these people that are on medication are not capable of having a spiritual experience. And he actually said that in front of a large group of people. And I started to twitch. and me and Byzance, it wasn't Byzance, but anyway, I said, really, do you really think that? How do you know that? How do you know that somebody can't have a spiritual experience or hasn't had one? What does it look like? You know, I don't think we can know that. I don't know what your spiritual experience is, you know. You know, I've never had an experience where the room turned white and stuff, but I've had spiritual experiences, and how do we know that people on medication have this veil over them, that they aren't connected somehow? You know, what do we know about the higher power? So the higher power says, oh, people on medication, I'm not connecting with them. Really? Really? Let's make that kind of an edict. You know? What good is that going to do us? You know? I don't know what your spiritual experience is going to look like. You know?
Well, I had an experience with Bob, and this is back in Soberman days, when I knew all. And there was a guy who came to me and he asked me to be his sponsor, and he'd been sober for a little while, and he said, I'm on medication. And I said, well, I'm not going to be able to sponsor you unless you go off the medication. And he called his doctor, and his doctor called me at 11 o'clock at night and just excoriated me. And I said to the doctor, I said, to the best of my ability, given what it is that I know, I can't work with this guy. So, I mean, I was straight up about it. And 10 years later, the guy comes up to me and he says, you remember that? Oh, yeah, I've never forgotten. And he goes, well, I've been off the meds for about 18 months. And he said, I can pray and I can meditate. He said, I wasn't able to all that time. So all that time, I was not hooked in. So, you know, again, this is just one guy. And I mean, I love this guy because his depression came from He moved in with his mother and drank a quart and a half of vodka a day and watched a little black and white television. I think I'd need medication.
Hey, just kind of piggybacks on that last statement is he could pray and meditate. So this question is, what if you pray and pray and invite, etc., and you...
Like invite.
Yeah, etc., and you still don't feel or know God at times, parentheses. Just keep trying, question mark. So I think one of the nice things about this question happening now is that there's a lot of other steps that make the prayer and meditation a clearer channel. And if you're praying and meditating and you owe the money still, and you sometimes feel connected and sometimes you don't, that might be the problem. If you're praying and meditating and you're living a certain way, or you're praying and meditating, or this is probably more likely in the groups that I attend a lot, is people do the steps in their circle, in their room, in their home, and they go to their meetings, but they haven't talked to another alcoholic who's in trouble in 10 years. And your prayer and meditation life will shrivel on the vine, because God is outside.
And, get off the couch.
So yeah, you got to get off the couch. So Jay might want to feel some of this too.
Oh no,
you good?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay.
Were you done?
I'm done.
Okay. Do you think it's right to say the Lord's Prayer after an AA meeting?
Now my Stop.
Now there's an elegant article that if you are an AA member, I highly recommend that you get a subscription to aagrapevine.org, and because there's all this stuff, all these wonderful articles written, and there's a wonderful article that Bill wrote about saying the Lord's Prayer and where it came from and all this. Interesting that the Lord's Prayer is a rabbi's, it's a compendium of Hebrew wisdom. The Serenity Prayer is written by a Lutheran minister. It's a Christian prayer. The Lord's Prayer is not a Christian prayer. It's a collection of Hebrew wisdom. Yet, you know, it's identified falsely as... But anyway, I judge no group. But the thing is that... one of the things that has been a very interesting change in the postmodern era is that the people that I come in contact with have no relationship at all with traditional religious training. And I kind of, just for my own thing, I mean, I think bad religious training is a lot better than none at all.
I wouldn't argue.
And that this particular compendium of Hebrew wisdom is probably one of the most elegant and important pieces of information that can be imparted to any human being, especially one who's in trouble. And that if somebody can learn that particular compendium of wisdom, that they got a much better shot at staying sober. And you know, one of the pieces that really informed our society was Emmett Fox's The Sermon on the Mount. And you know, and in that there's the breakdown of the Lord's Prayer. There's also another thing, Glenn Clark's I Will Lift Up Mine Eyes, that both Bill and Bob read, that has a very, very elegant exercise of going through the Lord's Prayer in the beginning that had a profound experience. I had a profound experience with when I was exposed to it. And so I believe that it's a very important piece. I think that if we eliminate prayer from the meeting, I personally believe that the prayer with which we seal the meeting is probably the most important thing that we do. I'm very fortunate that in my group, which is filled with pagans, and but that one of the things that we do is we invite people to ask the group to pray for folks. And it's very interesting that a couple of the leading pagans are the folks that are the ones who use that the most and who have found that to be the most consoling part. So again, I think that prayer is a very, very important part of the experience of Alcoholics Anonymous and of the meetings. And so I think that the Lord's Prayer is fine, and the people generally that that are talking about it are people who have a corollary resentment. In other words, like my wife, who is Jewish, who was very, very frightened that the Jew police were going to find her praying on her knees when she was getting sober. You know, that was supposed to elicit a laugh. It does when she says it. I'm sorry, Adele, I won't.
You didn't know there were Jew police, did you?
Jew police?
Yeah, they were all, they think they're only in Beverly Hills. But they're not
now
necessarily in rural Louisiana. But anyway, that I believe that that the Lord's Prayer is a wonderful tool in our set of spiritual tools. And yeah.
Well, and the thing, like, I agree with Jay that there's a resentment behind that question, most likely. And then I had a friend who's a Buddhist, and he would say, you know, that's a Judeo-Christian prayer. And I said, yeah, AA didn't come out of a vacuum. You know, it came in the 30s and did everything it could not to tell you what to believe spiritually. But prayer and meditation, as we like to say, it's Jay's phrase, but the 11th step is not extra credit, it's a step. And that just happens to be that the Lord's Prayer is the best known prayer in the United States. And otherwise, you've all heard of the Tower of Babel, right? We could all just say whatever prayer we want. It's a way for us to pray together. It's just like if you have a problem, the best argument I heard is a guy in front of ours, Mike B. I've mentioned him earlier, he's a comedy writer. And he said, oh, yeah, if you have a problem with a God thing, I had that. My advice is get over it. Because you want to get well. And if you have a problem with the Lord's Prayer, again, it's a circumstance. It's about you, that problem. You'll find another circumstance in AA there where they're all over. It's a way for us to commune together. So they're just words.
In India, they don't say the Lord's Prayer.
No.
You know, I mean, AA's, it's a cultural thing, and it changes when you, if you travel through it. You'll see it be different in different places, and they say different things. You know, and I sponsor a lot of the pagans in the meeting. We're the pagan crew. And my advice to them is resign from the goddamn debating society. That's what he told me. This isn't your program. It's ours. You need us. We don't need you. You know? It says here, pray. Let's pray. Why don't we? I don't give a shit what you want. You know? I really don't. I really don't. It's irrelevant. You know, your concepts are. I'm not sensitive to them. Nobody was sensitive to mine.
You know? He almost hit me.
Yeah, a couple times. Yeah. You know? But we're doing AA now. We're doing AA. This is AA. Now, I was involved in general service. And at the area assembly one year, this was some years ago, they had this huge debate about whether we should say the Lord's Prayer at the end of the area assembly, our local Area 9 area assembly. It was really interesting. People brought up some good stuff. And I was probably 5 or 6 years sober, so this was all kind of news to me. And I'm watching this debate, and I had a specific opinion about this, believe it or not. And I thought, it should not be said. I mean, it keeps people are offended by it, and you just shouldn't say it. You know, I mean, it was clear to me. And so there was a bunch of guys getting up there stating that position quite eloquently, you know. Then there were guys that were opposed to talk about the tradition of it, which is what Bill Wilson said. It's become a tradition. It's just a tradition. You know, it's like, relax, relax. It's not a big deal. And they had this big argument, and then there was a vote. And they voted, and it was voted that we would say the prayer, but it was very close margin. So in general service, they let the minority speak again. And I go, this is ridiculous. We already solved this problem, but, you know, maybe we'll win. So the minority gets up there and spoke about it again, and people said some great stuff, and they voted again. You know, and it was still just narrowly passed, you know, that we're gonna say the Lord's Prayer, right? So at the end of the meeting, and this was hot and heavy, and it went over like an hour overtime, you know. We're all holding hands, and the guy that chose the prayer said the Lord's Prayer. He's going to do the Serenity Prayer. And people, the whole place roared at the end of it. You know? And I remember thinking how serious these people were and what a great argument this was. And at the end, it ended with laughter. It ended with laughter because there are much more important things to discuss than that.
And this brings us to a very good question that we didn't answer before, but it's a good place, and it's probably behind this question too. There was a question: do you think AA is a cult? And I'll tell you,
absolutely.
Yeah, there's that. Have I ever thought that? First, I'll tell you the reason. This is a place where, through a phenomenon, if you read the book, things came together that put together a set of surrenders or spiritual exercises that have proved to be almost airtight if you want to overcome the problem of alcoholism. I've never seen anyone truly, honestly and truly working the 12 steps get drunk. I've seen people have issues and go off on fall in love and stop going to meet, but somebody who's really paying the money back, they're really working with others, I just don't see that. There's usually an underlying thing happening. So that's what we found, right? A miraculous thing happened one day when Ebbie Thatcher, for some reason, thank God he said this, said to Bill Wilson, why don't you choose your own idea of God, Bill? And then the whole world could come. That's why I never give money to those damn people outside of Target. Goes Christian Brotherhood to help drug addicts. Ah, that's all right. I'll help drug addicts. I'm going to walk right by them. You don't have to be a Christian Brotherhood to help drug addicts. So there's this. We don't tell you what to believe. We do have structure. We have 12 steps. We don't have a hierarchy. Does it sometimes feel like a cult? Yes, the inmates are running the asylum. Yeah, you know, yes, yes. There are meetings where it feels cultish, you know, because the sick are helping the sick here. And I'll tell you, one day I was in the Monday Night Men's Stag, our home group. It was probably 10 years ago, about 8 years sober, and they called on me, and I was going to tell them Alcoholics Anonymous transformed my life and blah, blah. And I just wasn't believing that at the moment. And I said, you know what? What I think right now is all of you people are completely full of shit, and alcohol is harmless. And then I stopped sharing, because that's what I believed. And I went home. By the time I got home, there was a message on my machine from Jay, and it said, we are completely full of shit, and alcohol is harmless, but you can't drink. So, where do I go? I got to go back to the cult. That's my 2 cents.
Well, I shaved my head.
Yeah.
No, I think that a couple things, and also dovetail with this thing about we are the furthest thing there is from a cult. And I think for us even to give it a laughing assent is as misguided as people calling zealous members of Alcoholics Anonymous Nazis, which is the most and believe me, I was guilty of this. And my sponsor, the first time he heard me say it, just grabbed me by the. They used to be able to do this to you. You know, they would grab you or they'd pound on your chest.
And he said, me too.
Yeah, he said, there is nothing further from Alcoholics Anonymous than Nazism. Don't you ever, ever use that. Gee, what do you mean, Greg? but you know, and he was right. He was right about that. And any time that we use that word to describe a zealous member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and usually it's a backhanded compliment, and it's something that is so spiritually misguided that I really ask you to please, whenever you hear anybody say it, to just stop them for a second and say, you know what? It's not right. And a cult, the Oxford group was a cult. The Oxford Group had the leader that could not be questioned, that had a direct and very interesting connection with the power, that people followed him into all kinds of interesting things. And I'm a member, man. I mean, I'm with these guys. But that's a cult. One of the interesting things about it is that it actually survived the death of the leader. In cults, that doesn't happen. In Alcoholics Anonymous, you and I are heir to the most amazing form of democratic representation that has belief in a power as its central fact and is set up in such a way that there cannot be politicking and there cannot be a hierarchy. Because when it goes to the third vote and it's too close, what do? We go to the hat. We go to the hat. How can that possibly work? And yet it has. And the man who developed that walked away from his creation in 1955. Walked away from it. And he lived another 14 years. Walked away from it. So for us even to backhandedly, cutely say, oh, AA is a cult. Horrible, horrible crime against the spiritual legacy that you and I should be cognizant enjoyers of. And if you have, excuse me, one more thing. And if you haven't been a member of General Service yet, God damn it, do it. You need to put your 2 years in. And if you're going to be an AA member, excuse me, rant, you got to spend 2 years in H&I. You got to spend a minimum of 2 years in general service. If you got sober at the Ilano Club, you got to be on the board, which is really tough.
Oh.
Okay, you got to go to the you got to be involved in the central office. That's 8 years you can't drink at all. And then you only do that after you've been a treasurer and a cleanup person. So you can't drink for 12 years. That's just it. Okay, thank you.
So I did not backhandedly cutesy call it a cult. I want to be clear. Okay. I said, does it sometimes feel like a cult? Yes, the inmates are running the assignment. Some groups have made this into a cult. They have a leader. He cannot be questioned, and he's followed completely. Okay? Watch out. That's not AA. Okay? Does it sometimes feel like a cult? Yes, it does, because we are imperfect people that turn this into something else.
Yeah, that's what I said. Special underwear and secret handshakes.
Yes. And you're absolutely right.
Thank you.
The biggest difference is here it's safe to drink the Kool-Aid.
Well, the truth about AA is it is probably the single most significant social movement of the 20th century. David Hawkins, I mean, this is true. I'm not, Ken, this isn't just a rant. There's a lot of people that believe this. David Hawkins, in his book Power versus Force, he says he makes an estimate, however good this is, but you tell me if this isn't your experience, that probably 50% of the population of North America has been touched by Alcoholics Anonymous. That's close to 300 million people. There's nothing else that's done that in the 20th century. Nothing comes even close to it. You know, nothing at all. I mean, you can't talk to anybody that doesn't have somebody that's in an AA program. And there's close to 300 12-step programs now that have all spun off of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's every kind of 12-step program you can imagine. We were sitting out here earlier today talking about churches. Almost all churches now have some sort of a 12-step group they put together that everybody can come to. You know, the overeaters, the gamblers, the sexual problems, whatever it might be. You know, they're all trying to incorporate this because they've seen what's happened. It has changed the face of psychotherapy. Psychotherapy, where the whole concept of group therapy came from, is Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you look at it like that, you travel around it a little bit, you'll hear people say that AA's lost its edge, that we've kind of lost something somewhere, that we used to have a 75% success rate, now it's 5%. This is all bullshit. This is all bullshit.
That.
There was never a 75% success rate. Most of the people in the stories in the first edition of the Big Book got drunk or committed suicide. A couple of them killed themselves. I mean, it's hard sobering you assholes up. You know, I mean, it doesn't happen very easy. I mean, we do this whole presentation where it talks about the slow growth at the beginning, and then how it exploded, And right now, the way they do the statistics, they have no idea how many members there are. We use the figure 2 million. It could be 4. They say 150,000 groups. Could be 300,000. It's definitely not less. If you study, you can download this from our website. And I've got some cards here. If you send me an email, I'll put you on my little quote list and stuff, and I'll give you the website. And you can download this information from the website if you want. It's really interesting. When you study how they compile the statistics, the first thing you realize, they have absolutely no idea how many of us there are. But look at the young people coming into AA now. You know, if it's happened to you, I mean, recovery is accessible at all levels of society for any kind of problem you can imagine. It has grown and exploded on a level that no one's ever seen anything like this before. And that's where you and I are today. Is it a cult? It's a movement. It's a social movement, and it transcends just the not drinking thing. There's a lot of other stuff going on here.
And having heard what Bill and Jay just said about the power of this thing and the magnitude of it, who cares if we say the Lord's Prayer at the end? You know, is that what we're going to fight about? Or are we going to fight about how to be vital and alive so that people keep coming? And you know the reason it's not a cult
point
is we don't come and get you. We never come and get you. You come to us. Yeah, you come to us. You know, that's when somebody's yelling at me about working the steps, I'm like, I'm sorry, I thought you asked me to sponsor you. And now I'm getting F-bombed on, you know. So.
You ever got on a 12-step call and you had the guy tell you how you should adjust your approach to him? I've had that experience. I looked at one guy and I go, I'm making this 12-step call, not you.
You're
Saturday night,
guy.
He was just lonely. You know, it's like, you call AA, we'll show up. They know that.
Did anybody have a question? Are we ready for a fire?
And then I asked a friend if he'd...
Play some music for us.
Would you end us up with a song again, just so that we don't do the Lord's Prayer?
We're going to lose a member.
He's going to sing the Lord's Prayer, you know. Our Father.
The Catholics put you. Are they?